First, we'll look at the numbers from the Odessa American. Ector County, total cases both confirmed and probable, 4,382. Ector County negative, 19,974 out of 24,679 tested, with 323 pending, 76 deaths. Recovered, 3,662. Active, 644. Midland County, 3,362 confirmed cases and 74 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, new coronavirus deaths in Texas are on the decline after record highs in August. 3,701 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 8th, 443 less than a week ago. They occupy 6.8% of hospital beds. 1,416 new cases were reported on September 8th. The latest positivity rate is 8.4%. 13,553 Texans have died as of September 8th. 61 more deaths reported than the day before and 872 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $38.41. That's up $1.65. Before we begin reading our articles, this note, we will also have as many pre-recorded reports as we have time for toward the latter part of the program. Here are coronavirus briefs. President Trump knew in early February coronavirus was dangerous, highly contagious, airborne, and deadly, according to an audio recording from Bob Woodward. Drug giant AstraZeneca paused a trial of its coronavirus vaccine because of an unexplained illness in one of the volunteers. As President Trump pushes for a coronavirus vaccine before the November election, one major vaccine trial has been halted after a participant developed symptoms of a potentially unexplained illness. After the British participant became sick, AstraZeneca and the University of Oxford paused human trials to evaluate whether the person's condition could be related to the vaccine. We will have more on that story in just a few minutes. With the number of 18 to 29-year-old Americans living with their parents increasing from 47% to 52% between February and July, according to the Pew Research Center, the largest number of young people have returned home since the Great Depression. Here are shorter articles. Pandemic seems to be leveling off in U.S., but numbers remain troubling high, experts say. The coronavirus pandemic appears to be leveling off in most of the United States, with new cases, deaths, and hospitalizations all down over the past week. But the plateau leaves the country with high and persistent infection numbers and worries of a post-Labor Day surge in some areas. The number of new cases reported daily peaked above 70,000 in July and has been falling since. The decline now seems to be slowing, with the daily number hovering to near 40,000 for more than a week, a review of nationwide data showed Tuesday. That is one sign that the infection may be leveling off. Although that is good news, the numbers suggest continued high levels of infection and a long road ahead, particularly as cold weather and the flu season approach. Without a vaccine or a major advance in treatment, significant reductions in new cases would probably require voluntary or mandated changes in behavior that experts say are unlikely 6 months into the public health crisis. One in five young adults hospitalized for COVID-19 need intensive care, research shows. Coronavirus can hit many young adults hard, new research shows. One in five young adults hospitalized for COVID-19 needs intensive care, and 2.7% of them die, according to research published Wednesday in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine. The researchers said that young adults with certain health issues could be just as susceptible to the virus as middle-aged adults without them. A team of researchers from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston studied 3,222 COVID-19 patients between 18 and 34, who were treated at 419 U.S. hospitals. About 21% of these patients ended up in the intensive care unit, and 10% needed a ventilator. 88 patients, or 2.7%, died. The researchers said that this in-hospital death rate is lower than the rate reported for older adults with COVID-19. For comparison, they note that the rate is about double the death rate for young adults with heart attacks. Many patients had underlying health conditions, which put them at greater risk of negative outcomes. The team identified 24.5% of patients with morbid obesity, 18.2% with diabetes, and 16.1% with high blood pressure. Young adults with more than one of these conditions faced risks comparable with those observed in middle-aged adults without them, they wrote. Black and Hispanic people accounted for 57% of the hospitalized patients, which is in line with reports of minority people of all ages being hit harder by the coronavirus pandemic. The researchers noted that odds of death or mechanical ventilation did not vary significantly among different races. Research published in July found that 1 in 3 young adults is at risk of severe COVID-19. As rates of the virus increase among the younger population, the team says their findings highlight the importance of infection control among young adults. Risk of getting COVID-19 in the hospital is low, study finds. Although some patients have been avoiding essential care due to fears of catching COVID-19 in hospitals, new research published in JAMA Network Open on Wednesday suggests it's rare for people to catch the virus while at the hospital. Over the first 12 weeks of the pandemic in the U.S., our hospital cared for more than 9,000 patients, including approximately 700 with COVID-19, who were present for 8,656 hospital days. Researchers from the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute wrote, "Despite the high burden of COVID-19 in our hospital, we identified only 2 patients who likely acquired the infection in the hospital. There were 9,149 patients admitted to the Brigham and Women's Hospital between March 7th and May 30th, the first 12 weeks of the pandemic in the region. The researchers reviewed all patients diagnosed with COVID-19 either on the third or later days of their time in hospital or who were diagnosed within 14 days of having been discharged from the hospital. There were 697 initial diagnoses of COVID-19, 12 of which came 3 or more days into the patient's hospital stay. The only patient who definitely acquired COVID-19 in the hospital was most likely infected by a pre-symptomatic spouse who visited daily before their own diagnosis, 1 week before the patient started having symptoms. The case occurred before implementation of visitor restrictions and universal masking," the researchers said. Community-acquired infection was definite or likely for the other 11 patients. Of the 8,370 patients who were hospitalized with non-COVID-related conditions and discharged through June 17th, there were 11 positive tests within the healthcare system for COVID-19 in the 2 weeks after discharge. Only one case was deemed to be likely hospital-acquired, albeit with no known exposures inside the hospital, the researchers said. Now here's a series of vaccine-related articles. COVID-19 vaccine is a critical part of the solution to the pandemic, but not a magic bullet, expert says. While a vaccine for COVID-19 is not a magic bullet, it will play a critical part in managing the pandemic, according to Dr. Jeremy Farrar, director of the Wellcome Trust, a health research charity. "There are no magic bullets for infectious diseases," Farrar said during a news briefing by Wellcome Trust on Wednesday. "It's always a combination of public health, of treatments, of diagnostics, of behavior, of poverty, of course, and yes, in many cases where we're lucky, with vaccines as well." Farrar used Ebola as an example, saying, "Yes, it's fantastic to have an Ebola vaccine, but we all appreciate that it's one part of the picture, and COVID-19 will be identical." He added that the vaccine will be a critical part of the picture. He said he is optimistic that of all the vaccine candidates that are in development, there will be vaccines showing safety and efficacy data that could make a big impact on the pandemic, maybe during the later parts of 2020, but certainly in 2021. The first generation vaccines will not be perfect, in my view, but an imperfect vaccine can have a major impact on reducing transmission and preventing severe disease, he said. And the second generation vaccines will inevitably be better. As the coronavirus is a human endemic infection, Farah said that societies around the world will have to learn to live with the infection, manage it, and reduce its impact through vaccination, treatment, and diagnostics, as is done with many other infections. There is also the possibility that more than one vaccine will be needed if the virus mutates, and that new challenges could arise from new clinical symptoms or changes of the virus itself. This is with us for a very long time, Farah said, with a vaccine or without a vaccine. Pharmacists will be able to administer COVID-19 vaccine to anyone 3 and older, Surgeon General says. U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Jerome Adams announced that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services will be issuing guidance to expand access to safe and effective coronavirus vaccines. Adams said, per HHS, when COVID-19 vaccines are made available, state-licensed pharmacists will now be able to administer them to anyone aged 3 and older. Now more than ever, we need to help people understand vaccines are safe, vaccines are effective. Vaccines are how we achieve healthy equity and social justice, Adams testified in a hearing before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee on Wednesday. U.S. Surgeon General promises that vaccine cost will not be an obstacle for Americans. The Surgeon General of the United States promises he will not let the cost of a potential COVID-19 vaccine get in the way of getting people vaccinated. As Surgeon General of the United States, I promise you, we will use every federal tool that we have to make sure that cost is not an obstacle for people receiving what will perhaps be the most important and highly anticipated vaccine of our lives, Dr. Jerome Adams said. Speaking at the same Senate Health Committee hearing, Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, agreed with Adams 100%. U.S. health experts say AstraZeneca pause on COVID-19 vaccine trial is proof of due process. Health experts are applauding AstraZeneca for pausing its coronavirus vaccine trials due to an unexplained illness in one of the volunteers. It's a standard precaution in vaccine trials, meant to ensure experimental vaccines don't cause serious reactions. But Dr. Abdul El Sayed said the pause is reassuring because it shows that the process is not being rushed. They're going through the proper checks to make sure everything is safe and effective, the epidemiologist told CNN Wednesday. President Trump's escalated pressure on administration health officials to expedite work on a coronavirus vaccine raised concerns over the process that could lead to the approval of a candidate. Some experts have pointed out that public trust in a coronavirus vaccine is quickly dropping. With this skepticism, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital, also lauded AstraZeneca for observing due diligence. There's an enormous vaccine hesitancy in this country at baseline, and it is so much more important to have a vaccine that we trust that comes in February than one that we're skeptical about that comes in November. Because that skeptical vaccine is going to be really hard to overcome in the long term, she said. This is exactly how vaccine trials are supposed to work. When you see an adverse event, the due diligence needs to occur to see if it's related to the vaccine and interrogate it and make sure it's safe to move forward, Dr. Walensky added. How scientists are developing coronavirus vaccines at speed. A coronavirus vaccine is widely believed to be the best route to ending global lockdowns, and dozens of teams around the world are racing to develop one at a cost of billions of dollars. But despite U.S. President Donald Trump's prediction that a vaccine could be available by Election Day on November 3rd, researchers need to go through standard development pathways before most countries will permit distribution. These development stages typically take years, but scientists are combining phases as they work to find a vaccine against the SARS-CoV-2 at unprecedented speed. Some vaccine trials, for example, are combining phase 1 and phase 2 in order to run initial tests on several hundred people instead of smaller groups of 10 to 20. Others have skipped the initial animal testing phase in favor of testing on humans and animals in parallel. Three COVID vaccines are being tested in large-scale U.S. trials. The first two studies, one led by Moderna and the National Institutes of Health, and the other led by Pfizer and BioNTech, began in late July. Each study was designed to enroll 30,000 participants, and officials said both have enrolled about half that total. BioNTech CEO said Tuesday he was confident the company would have a vaccine against the coronavirus ready for regulatory approval by the middle of October. But Moderna and Pfizer are still not enrolling minorities in their clinical trials at the levels recommended by Dr. Anthony Fauci. AstraZeneca, which has been running large-scale clinical trials in Great Britain, Brazil, and South Africa, launched another large-scale vaccine study last week in the U.S. involving 30,000 volunteers. But the drug giant said Tuesday it had paused global trials because of an unexplained illness in one of the volunteers, a standard precaution to ensure experimental vaccines don't cause serious reactions among participants. Analysis. Most Americans won't be allowed to get a coronavirus vaccine as soon as it's approved. It's unlikely a coronavirus vaccine will be approved by Election Day, as President Trump is suggesting. But whenever the Trump administration does give a nod to a vaccine, it almost certainly won't be available for all Americans. The most likely scenario to play out is that the Food and Drug Administration would grant initial approval to vaccinate just frontline health workers, those older than 65, and those with underlying medical conditions. Two industry vaccine experts tell me it would come in the form of an emergency use authorization, a shortcut for the government to approve medicines and treatments in dire circumstances as large clinical trials continue. Full approval to distribute a vaccine to everyone else could take another 6 months beyond that, illustrating how, even in a best-case scenario, we're still well into 2021 before most Americans can get inoculated. This is still a significantly sped-up timeline. Trials will continue for about 5 years to make sure subjects aren't experiencing longer-term side effects. And now a couple of economic-related articles. What we know about the latest stimulus bill. GOP senators have unveiled their so-called skinny stimulus bill as Congress resumes debating the next coronavirus measures. The bill includes a $300 federal boost for unemployment benefits and fresh relief for small businesses, but cuts out money for a second round of stimulus checks that was included in an earlier proposal. What happens now? It could go to a vote this week, but it doesn't have unanimous GOP support, and Democrats want a bill in the trillions. There's still very little hope that both sides will come to a stimulus agreement before November's election. Even the threat of a government shutdown, which could happen when funding runs out at the end of the month, isn't a big motivator. Congress seems intent on a clean bill to keep the government running without stimulus attachments. Marriott is laying off about 17% of its corporate workforce. Marriott International is laying off 673 employees at its corporate headquarters in Maryland, a sign that the pandemic-stricken travel industry isn't close to recovering. The Maryland-based hotel chain announced the layoffs in a work adjustment and retraining notice. Marriott employs about 4,000 people at its Bethesda headquarters. Marriott has furloughed thousands of hotel employees as demand dried up. It's made no secret how badly COVID-19 is destroying business, saying in May that the pandemic is having a more severe and sustained financial impact on Marriott's business than 9/11 and the 2008 financial crisis combined. The stock is down 30% for the year. And now we will begin a series of our pre-recorded reports that we have for you today. Our first is from NPR, COVID-19 Roundup, case tally, school outbreaks, flu shot, vaccine wait. Here's that report.
We learned some important lessons from Memorial Day and July 4th this year. After those holidays, there was a surge in COVID cases both times. So as we go into Labor Day, public health experts are watching carefully. The news on the virus right now is mixed. The number of new cases is going down in the U.S., but there are new hotspots in the Midwest. NPR's Allison Aubrey is with us. She has the latest. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Noelle.
So this is our regular Monday check-in. Where do we stand on this Monday in the U.S.?
Well, after weeks of about 1,000 deaths a day, that number has declined to about 850 deaths a day. That's still a lot of people dying, Noelle, but it's an improvement, and the number of new cases is about 40,000 per day, a significant decline compared to the 60,000 cases back in July. But of course, it's Labor Day weekend, so if people have been out and about in crowds, as we saw Memorial Day, this could really set us back. And there are already hot spots throughout the Midwest and the South. And infectious disease experts I talked to say this coming fall, people spending more time indoors, people back to work or school, there will likely be a bump in cases given how widely the virus has been circulating and the change in seasons.
And we have already seen this happen in some schools and on some college campuses as students come back. Have any of them found it possible to contain outbreaks or to prevent them?
Well, you know, there's a range of strategies being used in group settings, in schools and daycares. CDC Director Robert Redfield has pointed to evidence from Rhode Island, where hundreds of daycare facilities opened this summer. There were some students and teachers who got infected, but by identifying them and isolating them, they were able to limit community spread there. So he says that's a success. Of course, to do this effectively, you got to identify people quickly, right? That's why some college campuses have mandated entry testing. I spoke to Eric Lander. He's the director of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, which has kind of overseen a testing program for about 100 college campuses in New England. Some of these schools are testing students and faculty two times a week, and so far this seems to be paying off.
Testing has identified already 450 infected people, because we know that they're not out there spreading to other people on the campus. That's the case for testing right now. That information is immediately actionable. By knowing, we can cut off the spread.
So when students test positive, they can be isolated. Now, of course, to prevent outbreaks, you need more than testing, right? Everybody's got to do the social distancing and masking and sometimes more stringent measures. At University of Illinois, where there's a very rigorous testing program, the school announced a temporary lockdown for undergraduates. The goal here is to quickly turn it around before it gets out of control.
Something I've been curious about, we obviously don't have a COVID-19 vaccine yet, but there seems to be a big push for people to get the flu vaccine. I keep getting emails from my doctor, my pharmacy. What's going on there?
Yes. Doctors are concerned because people have put off routine visits during the pandemic. So, for instance, child immunizations were way down this spring, according to an analysis by Komodo Health. They've bounced back some. But the message from doctors and pediatricians is this: come in and get your vaccine, especially the flu vaccine. If you ended up getting flu and COVID, which is possible, you could get really sick. I spoke to Michael Eisen. He's an infectious disease doctor at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago.
If you get sick with what you think may be the flu, you can't differentiate that based on symptoms from COVID-19. And so that'll mean those people are going to be seeing their doctor, asking for tests, needing health care.
And this could really overburden the healthcare system. That's why we're all being asked to keep up the social distancing, the masking, the hand washing, because the same strategies that help prevent COVID also help prevent the flu.
Now, in the meantime, we have a presidential election in 2 months. What's the latest advice or guidance on how to vote safely?
If you can vote by mail, that is a good option. But bottom line, polls will need to be open on election day for all the people who will vote in person. There's a lot of thought being given to big venues to maximize social distancing. For instance, in Baltimore, Camden Yards, the baseball stadium, has been considered as a possible voting site. I spoke to Myrna Perez. She's the director of the Voting Rights and Elections Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. That's at the NYU School of Law. She says another challenge here, more poll workers are needed this November.
Many of our country's poll workers have traditionally been people that are over 65, which are at greater risk of COVID complications. For that reason, we have people who either don't want to sign up to be a poll worker again or shouldn't be signing up to be a poll worker again. And as such, we need to expand who is serving as a poll worker, which means we're going to need a lot of people volunteering.
Hopefully younger people at lower risk of serious illness. So given that the virus is still circulating and we don't yet have a vaccine, that could be a good thing to do.
Yeah, sure. Last week, Allison, the CDC told states to be ready to distribute a vaccine by November. Now, there's some concern over this, right? People are worried that there's political pressure to get a vaccine done because the election is coming up. The Trump administration would like to win that election. Let's leave the politics aside and talk about the science. Are we likely to get a vaccine this year?
You know, if there is any kind of approval or emergency use authorization this year, it would likely start with a very narrow group of people, likely healthcare workers or people in nursing homes. Now, former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb spoke about the timing yesterday on CBS.
I think the likelihood that we're going to have a vaccine for widespread use in 2020 is extremely low. I think we need to think of that as largely a 2021 event. And if we do have a vaccine available in 2020, it's likely to be used in a much more targeted fashion, almost in a therapeutic sense, to protect very high-risk populations.
The current FDA Administrator, Stephen Hahn, has said it is possible the agency may review a vaccine maker's application and make some kind of determination based on the evidence so far before trials are complete. But again, it will likely be many, many months before all of us can be vaccinated.
A 2021 event, as Scott Gottlieb says. Allison Aubrey, thanks so much for your reporting. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Noel.
Now here's a report closer to home. Coronavirus outbreak causes strain in Rio Grande Valley of Texas.
A mariachi musician, a newspaper editor, and a priest all have seen their jobs and lives upended by the coronavirus in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. It's one of the hardest hit regions in the country, with more than 2,000 dead, and the specter of death looms large. We start our story in a cemetery in McAllen, Texas.
My name is Hector Guerra. I am one of the parts of the Mariachi Continental here in McAllen, Texas. And, you know, there's no place to play right now except the cemeteries. We're playing a lot of funerals. We're staying 6 feet away from each other. We're using our face mask. It's just gotten very, very sad and very serious. Of course, all the event centers closed down. All the celebrations that our culture usually does, quinceañeras, bodas, aniversarios, they've been canceled or have been postponed or eliminated till whenever, because we don't know what's going to happen. And it's unfortunate because we're seeing a lot of death. And, you know, I mean, I'm just flabbergasted with a small town newspaper as we have here in McAllen, Texas, 70 to 80 death notices a day.
My name is Veronica Diaz. And I oversee a group of graphic designers that design the newspapers for Valley Morning Star, The Monitor, and the Brownsville Herald. A year ago, I would say we would average maybe 7 to 10 death notices daily. Now, after COVID, we're looking at an average of 25 to 30 death notices, and last week we had 100 death notices in one day, yes. For me, it's surreal. You know, I spent a lot of time fixing errors, making sure the names are spelled right. I mean, all that adds a lot of stress to my work daily. We have 11 obituaries and 33 death notices for tomorrow. Eloy Alvarez is one obit. Cruz Gonzalez Martinez, Belinda Benitez Lara, Silverio Hernandez.
It's incredible. It's a nightmare. I still can't hardly believe it. I know that I'm not going to run and hide, but and I know that my job is not just to bury the dead, but to console those who are heartbroken. My name is Father Roy Snipes. I'm an Oblate of Mary Immaculate. I'm the pastor of Our Lady Guadalupe Parish. La Lomita, where we are right now, is our mother or grandmother church. So this is our little mission church. What we're doing with the coronavirus, instead of crowding together in the church or the funeral home, we'll just bring the body to the front of the church in the hearse, ring the funeral bell, and play a good song, like Blue Shadows or some good soothing song for your broken hearts. And then I'll bless the body in the hearse with the incense and with the holy water, and then accompany them to the grave. This is what I signed up for, and this is what I've always done, 40 years a priest. And I've always prayed to do a good job and not to be robotic or perfunctory, you know. But now this is like a tsunami. I'll end up the day thinking, dadgum, maybe I've got the virus. I feel sick and tired, and then I'll maybe take a shot of Old Crow and hit the bed, and then I wake up raring to go in the morning. Thanks be to God.
That was Hector Guerra, Veronica Diaz, and Father Roy Snipes. They spoke with NPR's John Burnett.
You may recall a few weeks ago there was a large motorcycle rally that was held in South Dakota. Well, now several states are reporting coronavirus cases linked to that rally. Here's this report.
Last month, more than 460,000 people from all over the country descended on Sturgis, South Dakota, for the city's annual 10-day motorcycle rally. They gathered there despite concerns the event was primed to spread coronavirus. South Dakota does not require masks in public or prohibit large gatherings, and a majority of residents in Sturgis were against the rally. Now we're starting to get a sense of the impact of that event, including one death. NPR's Will Stone has been tracking the story and joins me now. And Will, this rally wrapped up on August 16th. Sounds like COVID-19 cases have been connected to the rally, as people who opposed it feared would happen.
That's right. The running total is more than 250 cases, according to state health departments and media reports. And these are scattered all over the country, Colorado, Wyoming, Wisconsin, New Hampshire, more than 10 states. But the place with the biggest share connected to Sturgis is the home state, South Dakota. It currently has one of the worst infection rates in the country, and now they've linked more than 100 cases to Sturgis. And this is just our best estimate. Every day we learn of more.
So you've said that about 250 positive diagnoses at least, but nearly a 500,000 people came to that rally. So 250 doesn't seem like a huge number, given that 500,000 people came.
No, it's not, but this is far from a complete picture. First, and it hasn't been that long, and experts say we just can't draw too many conclusions yet. And tracking this is really hard. We have this patchwork of states reporting the data. Also, people need to know they have the virus and then voluntarily share that they went to Sturgis. Plus, we don't know how many secondary infections there are. So that's how many people caught the virus at the rally and then went on to infect others who never went. So public health experts say we'll probably never know the total number of infections associated with this rally.
But of course, there have been cases popping up all over the country, which was exactly the concern, that bikers would bring the virus home and spread it. What are public health officials saying about that?
Well, they're pretty frustrated. They say that this was really predictable. One state that's dealing with the aftermath is Minnesota. They've identified more than 45 cases, and one person has actually died. Here's what Chris Ayersman had to say. She's the infectious disease director at the state's Department of Health.
it's definitely frustrating because we certainly aren't surprised to see cases, and we recognize that it is really a result of this competing values. So obviously from public health, their goal is to reduce morbidity and mortality. For other people, their value may be that their freedom is more important.
And this rally became just another flashpoint. The state's Republican governor, Kristi Noem, who's a strong ally of President Trump, encouraged people to come, even though cases were starting to trend upwards even before Sturgis.
Sturgis has about 7,000 residents. How did this play out for them?
Sturgis actually did some follow-up testing for city employees, people who worked at the rally, and for residents who wanted to. Just 650 people were tested, but they found only 4% were positive. And that's about what they would have expected to find if they had tested people even before the rally. So city officials say this is evidence that they did a pretty good job keeping things safe, at least within the city, when they held this event.
That's NPR's Will Stone. Will, thanks for updating us on this Sturgis motorcycle rally.
Here's another story that's related to vaccines. This story explains how volunteers and scientists help determine if a vaccine works.
There are now three potential COVID-19 vaccines undergoing wide-scale testing in the U.S. Two more potential vaccines are also about to hit that phase. So how do we know whether these potential vaccines will be effective, and how soon will we know? NPR's Joe Palca is here to help answer those questions. Hey, Joe.
Hey there.
All right, let's start with the basics. So these potential vaccines will be tested in 30,000 people each. Is that a lot of people?
It sounds like a lot to me. Yes, it's going to be about 15,000 in each group. They divide them in half. Half will get the vaccine. Half will get a placebo, just an inert shot. And why 30,000? Well, it turns out that you have to test the vaccine in a lot of people because you don't know who's going to be exposed to the virus. And so you test in a lot of places around the country, hoping that that's where there will be virus circulating. I mean, think about it. A couple months ago, you would have said, oh, test in New York. There's a lot of cases there. But if you did that now, there are very few cases in New York. So it takes a long time for people to be exposed. I spoke with Holly Janes about this. She's a biostatistician at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle. And she told me early on it was decided to enroll a lot of people.
Primarily due to the uncertainty as to where those infections and disease endpoints will happen.
So, but basically, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is if you were in a situation where people were left and right all the time getting sick with COVID, if you wanted to test a vaccine under those circumstances, you wouldn't need so many people.
That's exactly right, right. If we knew exactly where that would happen, we could do a smaller trial.
But for now, they're sticking with a larger trial, 30,000 people. Half of them get the real vaccine. Half of them get an injection with basically nothing in it. What happens then?
You wait. You wait for what are called primary endpoints.
These trials will use as a primary endpoint laboratory-confirmed COVID disease.
That was Holly Janes again. She says, so, okay, if you get sick, you go and get tested to make sure that it was COVID and not something else. And you're looking to see if there are at least 50% fewer cases in the vaccinated group compared to the control placebo group.
And how long does it take to figure that out?
Well, that's not clear, because Holly Janes says these are the kinds of trials called an event-driven trial. And in this case, an event is a case of COVID-19.
An event-driven trial means that the primary analysis of the trial happens when you get enough events. And we don't know how long that's going to take.
In other words, when enough people get COVID, they can statistically meaningfully make a comparison between the vaccine group and the placebo group, that's when you stop the trial. And Jane says that the number will be around 150 cases of COVID-19 among the entire population of the people in the trial.
Okay, that part makes sense, but the people giving the injection don't know what's in the syringe, and the people getting the injection don't know what's in the syringe. So when you do get those cases of the virus, how do you know whether these people were in the placebo group or the vaccinated group?
Right. This is what's called a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, and the people who know are a group of people called the Data and Safety Monitoring Board. And these are completely independent people. They have nothing to do with the trial. Their only job is to look at the results from time to time. And they're looking to mostly make sure that there are no bad side effects, that people aren't getting sick from the vaccine. but they're also looking to see if there's a clear indication that the vaccinated group are getting fewer cases of COVID than the control group.
And when could we have an answer by?
Well, the president has been hinting that there could be an answer, you know, even as soon as the end of October. But Mansef Slaoui, who's the chief scientific advisor to the administration's Operation Warp Speed, appeared to pour cold water on that in an interview he did last night with All Things Considered.
There is a very, very low chance that the trials that are running as we speak could read before the end of October.
What's the drawback to putting out a vaccine too soon? What does too soon mean?
Well, too soon means if you're not sure if the vaccine doesn't actually work, then people could take it and get sick and die if they were told it was safe and effective and it's not. And if it wasn't safe, then perfectly healthy people would put their health at risk by taking the vaccine. And if the vaccine is perceived as a flop by the public, it will undermine confidence in the government because they said it was safe and effective. And confidence in the government is something that's in short supply at the moment.
Yeah, fair enough. NPR's Joe Palca. Joe, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And now here's one of those news you can use kind of articles that we talk about sometimes. Here's a report about researchers saying fresh air can prevent aerosol transmission of the coronavirus.
Researchers say there is increasing evidence that in crowded indoor spaces, the coronavirus is spreading through the air and causing super spreading events. NPR's Ping Wang explains what they think is happening and how researchers say you can protect yourself.
6 months ago, 53 people caught coronavirus at a now notorious choir practice in Washington State. It raised a big red flag for scientists like Jose Luis Jimenez at University of Colorado Boulder, who study how the coronavirus spreads.
People who were 50 feet from the index case got infected.
Before everybody got sick at this choir practice, most scientists thought the coronavirus was really only spreading when people came within 6 feet of each other. Since then, it's become clearer and clearer that in certain situations, especially crowded rooms with stale air, clouds of coronavirus breathed out by infected people can accumulate in the air.
Wafted by air currents and travel around the room and be inhaled by other people.
That's Lindsay Marr, an engineering professor at Virginia Tech. She says these clouds of coronavirus floating through the air seem to be playing a key role in superspreading events where the coronavirus spreads to a lot of people at once, at weddings and nursing homes, prisons and dorms. Jimenez at UC Boulder says the unifying thread seems to be in closed spaces with a lot of people and not a lot of air. So there's situations he stays away from.
We have to avoid if it's crowded, if people cannot keep the distance, if it's a long time, if there is low ventilation, if people are not wearing masks, or if people are talking, or especially singing, or yelling, or also breathing hard.
That is a lot of things to try to remember to avoid. What you can do instead, Jimenez says, is spend time outside.
I think if you are outdoors with distance and with a mask that is well fit, I would say it's extremely difficult to get the disease that way.
He says you can think of these coronavirus clouds as plumes of smoke. Researchers think you have to get a concentrated whiff to get sick, so if you're outside, surrounded by fresh air, any virus clouds will disperse pretty quickly. And if you have to go indoors to a shared public space like the post office or the supermarket, Seema Lakdawala, a flu researcher at the University of Pittsburgh, says keep your distance from others and keep it moving.
You're not in one space for any prolonged period of time. And so even if there are fine aerosols that are released by somebody who is infected, they're getting diluted out as these people move and air currents pick them up.
And if you are in charge of people gathering indoors at your house or in your store or in a classroom, Marr at Virginia Tech says try to make the indoors more like the outdoors and get that stale air moving.
If you can kind of sweep that out and replace it with outdoor air, that can help reduce the problem of buildup of viruses in indoor air.
You can open a door or put a fan in the window to exchange the air. Researchers say that in most settings, these potential virus clouds can be dispersed with a light breeze and some fresh, clean air. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Now we're going to bring you three stories at once. They're all related to the economy. The first report you'll hear is how people are scraping by after expiration of federal unemployment aid. The next will be economic pain from pandemic is much worse than expected. And then a story about a landlord talking about the CDC's halt on evictions.
A new survey measures the financial pain as the pandemic goes on. Almost half of American households have suffered serious financial losses, we're told. In a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In the country's four largest cities, the situation is even worse, especially for Latinos and Black Americans. 50 to 80% of those households report serious financial problems. They can't pay their rent or their mortgage or their credit cards, and they've depleted what savings they have had. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports on the findings.
The pandemic is creating serious financial problems, job loss, depleted savings, or possible eviction. That's despite hundreds of billions in government stimulus and other support. The survey shows economic stress running higher in the country's four largest cities, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Houston. Latino and Black families were substantially more likely to face serious economic distress compared to white counterparts. Robert Blendon is a professor of health policy and political analysis at Harvard and co-author of the survey. He says the results show the personal financial challenges run deeper and broader than previously understood.
I would have expected that all the aid that was coming from various sources would have narrowed, not eliminated, the differences by race and ethnicity.
The survey, conducted this summer, also found more distress among households making less than $100,000 a year. It suggests a lack of funds creating knock-on effects, trouble paying for food or medical care, which in turn led to serious health consequences. The survey's implications could mean everything from a bigger drag on the economy to the nation's mental health outlook. And Blendon says the prognosis is grim. At the time of the survey, the federal government was offering $600 a week in additional benefits for the unemployed. That was not renewed after July.
It's going to get worse because there is nothing for the people we survey who earn under $100,000 a year in minority communities or not working full time to fall back on.
Cynthia Macklin is 66 and lives alone in downtown Chicago. Her 45-year career in medical administration ended 8 years ago when she got chronic lung disease. Her disability led to major depression, none of which have been treated during the pandemic.
I have not seen my pulmonary doctor to listen to my lungs, to check my oxygen levels, my psychiatrist. I haven't seen him in about 4 months, my primary doctor. I haven't seen her. So all these things have an impact.
The battery recently died on Macklin's truck, which she relies on to get groceries and medicine. The $1,200 federal stimulus check she received helped pay for it, she says, but that money is now long gone. Financial stressors, she says, make it harder for her to breathe and manage her depression.
This will be the first month that I'm not going to be able to pay rent. I sent my landlord an email yesterday asking him what could I do.
Macklin says she's lost 8 friends and relatives to COVID-19, including her ex-husband, the father of her 2 daughters.
It was the second week of March, all of a sudden he got sick, so he passed away. He didn't have a place to stay, so I was letting him stay here with me.
Above all, Macklin says, coping alone is lonely.
I try so hard not to cry. I guess just speaking to you has opened things up, and that's what has me crying now. But I try so hard. I have 9 grandkids and 7 great-grandkids that I would love to see them, but can't.
In the NPR poll, 1 in 5 people said family members couldn't get care for serious medical conditions. For those in Houston, the survey found 75% suffered negative health consequences as a result. There is, in other words, a magnifying effect. Ronette Ramos is a managing attorney at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles, which helps low-income families on a range of issues, from employment and housing to medical benefits. She says she's seen a surge in calls.
There is a minimum of at least 3 issues per phone call. Whether it is housing insecurity, so they're not able to pay their rent because of their loss of job, or they're dealing with food insecurity. It was leading to their anxiety or their high blood pressure.
Ramos says some landlords harass their tenants, trying to find ways around state and federal moratoria on evictions. That's exacerbating what was already a big housing crisis in L.A.
Renters pay more than 50% of what they make towards rent. So that doesn't leave much room for life upheaval. And, you know, we've been almost now in 6 months of life upheaval.
Gregory Cooper moved out of Houston after over a year without work. He spent 30-plus years in accounting and operations in the oil and gas industry.
I mean, I have an MBA and I have 2 certifications, but I'm struggling still.
Unemployment forced Cooper, who is 60, to move in with his elderly mother in Alexandria, Louisiana. He finally landed a government accounting job making about $40,000 a year, half what he used to make. He says it would be terrifying to be without a job.
Will you be able to get a job because of the age? Would you be able to get a job because of being black? We're almost the last people to recover when it comes to unemployment.
Cooper says he worries about intensifying unrest over the racial inequities in education and employment. But it also feels familiar.
Seeing our parents do it and show us how to make ends meet to actually keep your head up and get through the struggle. Sometimes is good versus being born with a silver spoon in your mouth.
But for Alvaro Castro, financial hardship is a new experience. The father of 2 was born in Colombia and lives in a suburb of Miami. He was making more than $100,000 a year until he lost his television producer job last September. He since found work making less as a contractor.
I was behind in my mortgage payments. I was behind in my cars. My insurance.
He put 2 cars in storage to reduce the insurance payments.
All the stuff, that kind of things that we had to figure out how to reduce.
But there were some things they could not postpone, like his wife's cataract surgery in April.
And I remember that she calling me from the hospital and the clinic, and she called and said, I don't have enough to make the copayment.
They moved funds around to scrape together the $250 copayment. The pandemic, he says, has given him different perspective.
Money is not the most important factor in our life. Maybe the most important factor in our life is the way that you relate with the others, the way that you share the time with your loved ones, or the way that you already appreciate how they feeling about you.
That, he says, is the only silver lining. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
President Trump and the CDC have ordered a nationwide halt on evictions until the end of December. This could prevent millions of Americans from becoming homeless during a pandemic and record unemployment. But some landlords say this moratorium leaves landlords unsheltered from financial difficulties. Katrina Bellella owns property in Chicago, but she joins us now from New York, where she's living with family and friends. Ms. Bellella, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And may we ask why you're staying with family and friends right now?
I am staying with family and friends because, ironically, my tenants have displaced me. So I own a unit in Chicago. I bought it about 3 years ago. My intention was to stay there and live there. Then I was relocated to Denver for work. So I decided I will rent out my apartment so that when I eventually move back to Chicago, I can live in my home. So I found these tenants. They signed a lease October of 2019. Mm-hmm. And since then, it has been an absolute nightmare. They paid rent late every month, and I tried my best to work with them. I understand, you know, we're human, things happen. I figured getting some rent was better than no rent. Then March rolled around. They owe me $630 from March. And since then, I have not seen a single penny in rent. The lease ended in April. They've been squatting in my apartment since then. And I could not afford to pay my rent in Denver and my mortgage in Chicago. So I moved out of Denver and I am now living with family and friends.
Hmm. What are your monthly expenses on your place in Chicago?
So there's a bunch of expenses. So there's my mortgage. I also have HOA fees, my homeowner's insurance, and taxes. And that all comes out to about $1,700 a month. I am still paying those bills.
You've got tenants who won't pay anything to you. And at some point, you must begin to run out of money also.
Yep. I could potentially lose my property. And which
I renovated myself. I, you know, paid my friends in pizza to help paint the walls. We redid the floors. Like, it's, I truly consider this my home. It's not an income property.
Are there any kind of assistance programs that might help you in Cook County or the state of Illinois?
So there is one program that it's a $5,000 grant. Your tenant has to apply for it. Around 200,000 tenants have applied, and it's a lottery. About 30,000 landlords will receive $5,000. Mm-hmm. My tenants owe me over $12,000 in rent. So if I am able to get into that lottery, that would be incredible, but it unfortunately really only helps a little bit.
Is there anyone you can ask for help? I imagine you've surveyed the landscape pretty much already.
I think absolute worst case scenario, I could maybe ask my parents, but my parents are older. They want to retire and, you know, they're not going to retire because I have to support my tenants. That's not right. My dad was furloughed and my mom actually has cancer. So she's been on leave. So I have, you know, my own personal things going on as well.
I hate to ask this, but have you thought about evicting your tenants?
Yes. So I actually contacted an attorney in March when they were late and not paying. They stopped responding to me completely. I had no idea what to do. This is the only place I own. I'm not like a professional landlord by any means. And he recommended that I try to evict them. And the purpose of that was actually to just start a conversation. So I figured if they received an eviction notice, maybe we could start a conversation, work something out. So my first court date was scheduled for July 20th. Then I received a notice that it had been moved to August 17th. And now I received another notice that it has been moved to December 23rd. By then, my tenants will have been in my unit rent-free for 9 months.
And will owe you almost $20,000 or something.
About that, yep.
On the other hand, in this economy, if you evicted them, would there be any guarantee anybody else could move in?
If I am able to get them out, I will probably just try to sell this unit. I just accepted that I probably won't be getting any of that money back, to be honest. The sooner I can get my tenants out, the sooner I can sell my property and stop losing on it every single month.
In the best of all possible worlds, the people who are in that apartment now would be able to pay, right?
Yes.
But they can't at the moment.
They can't, or they will not. I'm not sure. The unfortunate truth is that we do have tenants that are taking advantage of the situation. Right now, the way the eviction moratorium is written, there is no incentive for tenants to work with landlords. My tenants haven't spoken to me in months, and they legally don't have to. With the housing crisis, it's now somehow become my civic duty to provide free housing. It doesn't make any sense. And we're putting this burden solely on landlords.
Katrina Belilla, who owns a small property in Chicago, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Wednesday, September 9th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and here are some of the things that are coming up for you later today. Next, we'll have, of course, USA Today with the national news, and then at 3 o'clock, the local news that our volunteers will be reading. Here are some of those articles we'll read today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Myers says there are ways bars can reopen safely. DPS trooper ready to fill leadership void in District 4. Trinity has national merit semifinalist. From the Odessa American, UTPB students answer the call. And American Tribute begins this week. There's also one additional article that we'll bring you we didn't have time for yesterday. This article we'll be reading came from Sunday's MRT. It's a doctor writing this article as a commentary that appeared on the front page. Despite my best efforts, COVID killed my patient. A very fascinating insight into a doctor's mind who is treating people in the pandemic. All those and more coming up at 3 o'clock. And then at 6 o'clock, the Wall Street Journal. This quick reminder, at 7 o'clock tonight, we will have our Center Solutions podcast program. Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.
It's 52 and mostly cloudy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 50s. Then tomorrow a few showers with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night partly cloudy with a low in the mid 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.